Hey, Corey here. We've had an influx of new listeners, and so I just want to make sure that if you are new to the podcast, you don't just jump in and start listening to these daily episodes, which we've been doing. Please go back and listen to the first at least 8 episodes so you have an idea of what Collapse is, what it is that Corey is talking about. Also, if you've been with us for a while and you're enjoying the content, please join us on Patreon. We would love to see you there. There's a link, as always, in the description. All right. Collapse in 2024. We've reached the end of another year. And as I think back to previous years, we've done this episode at the end of 2023, end of 2022, end of 2021, and end of 2020. So this is the fifth year that we have done a collapse in review for the year. And it's interesting to think about the changes over the last 5 years as things have gone up and down, and the way that these reviews change over time. I think back to, and I wish that we had had the podcast 10 years ago. I wish we could have seen what a 2014 year in review would have looked like in Collapse. Because yes, there was still a lot going on around that time. It feels like everything is just ramped up. These last 5 years have been far and above, just beyond what I think we would have expected the world to look like. And that's not to say that, like, we're in the midst of this massive free fall and everything is collapsing around us. Like, yes, that is happening, but we're not in the worst of it, right? Things will definitely continue to progress. And I'm sure in 5 years and in 10 years, we'll look back at these 5 years and say, wow, wish we could go back to that. So I guess that's to say that there's maybe something to be grateful about. But for now, let's take a look back through the year at some of the big stories, some of the items that signify or contribute to the collapse of our global civilization. I do want to mention that, of course, I'm not mentioning everything here. There will be plenty of stuff that I missed. In some cases, I've picked some specific examples of things just to give an example. It doesn't mean that, if I've left a story out that either A, it was intentional, or that B, it was because I felt it wasn't important. That's not the case. There's just so much to discuss and talk about that I picked what I thought was relevant and what came to mind. So first, with the climate. We had the warmest year on record since records began in 1850, just warmer than last year, which was also the warmest year on record for its time. So we're continuously setting record after record. Obviously, we have been in an El Nino, which means that, we're in a spike. Things are abnormally hot. But we do not know what this new normal will be. And you can't really call it a new normal because it's so rapidly and constantly changing now, but the baseline has shifted as far as like what we view as extreme, right? Exceeding 1.5 in a year should be considered absolutely extreme, but we may be to a point now where we never go back below that. We were 1.8 Celsius degrees above the 20th century baseline between January and November. Once December's over, we'll be able to see what it actually was, but it will likely stay around that average. 1.8 degrees Celsius this year. Guys, this is insane. It was just a couple of years ago that they were talking about 1.5 being something that maybe we could still avoid, and that maybe would happen around 2050. And according to, IPCC, the way they actually track the numbers, they will still say we haven't hit 1.5 because it's got to be, I think it's a running 30-year average or something like that. So, who knows how long it will be before they actually say, okay, we've hit 1.5. But for all intents and purposes, like, we saw this year what being at 1.5 degrees Celsius over a prolonged period of time means. And as we even if we didn't keep growing, getting warmer, those tipping points that we've talked about in other episodes, those are going to be crossed. And as we cross those tipping points, again, without even having to get any warmer, things will continue to progress. As we get warmer, it's going to accelerate. It's going to get worse. And who knows? Maybe we dip back down below 1.5 degrees after, you know, in La Nina, or as we really move into this neutral Enzo, which we're in right now, which just started. So it'll be interesting to see what happens next summer. But this year, record-breaking 1.8 degrees Celsius above the 20th century baseline. And so I guess we could say congratulations, everybody, on reaching a new milestone. Okay, some specific examples. So there was an Antarctic heat wave this year. In July, Antarctica experienced a prolonged heat wave with temperatures soaring up to 28 degrees Celsius, which is 50 degrees Fahrenheit, above average. Now, in a lot of cases, that may mean it was still below freezing, right? But just not near as cold as it normally is. And what's terrifying about that, number one, that can prevent ice buildup, which means that melting in the summer becomes more severe. But it also can mean that, you know, as things get warmer and that baseline shifts, it was 50 degrees above average this year, Fahrenheit. Well, maybe it's 60 degrees next year or 70 degrees. And suddenly that does take it into melt territory. And Antarctica, which is supposed to be just this foundation, this bedrock of global climate security, this thing that was never going to be affected, is suddenly seeing huge and rapid changes and effects. And so, you know, we've talked about the Doomsday Glacier, as it's called, and the unpinning of Thwaites and all of that could have some quick and rapid effects on the future of Antarctica. So something to keep an eye on. The Arctic became a carbon source. So rather than becoming a sink, it's now officially flipped to becoming a source when you take wildfire emissions into account. So if you don't take into account emissions from wildfires in the Arctic and the tundra, then it's neutral. It's basically not a sink anymore, nor a source. When you take those wildfire emissions into account, it is now a source. It is creating more carbon than it is consuming or neutralizing. That is an issue because for so long, the Arctic has been a carbon sink. It's another tipping point because as it not only stops taking in carbon, but emits more carbon, it's just going to accelerate the rate at which we add CO2 to the atmosphere and at the rate at which we warm. The Arctic with these wildfires now, again, the wildfires themselves are a tipping point because they cause the release of CO2 and methane, not just from the fires burning, but also from the permafrost that melts and all of the anaerobic activity that happens within the permafrost itself and the releasing of methane through that process. So, yeah. In the U.S., I just picked U.S. numbers because that's where I live and it's harder to find global numbers, and the U.S. numbers are what we reported on in the past. But in the U.S., 24 natural disasters occurred this year, costing over $1 billion. Luckily, that is not as bad as last year, which had 28 natural disasters costing over $1 billion. However, we did beat last year in the amount of money that those natural disasters cost, and we ranked second all time for most costly hurricane year at around $200 billion in damages, which is just wild when you think about that amount of damages, $200 billion. Now, we ranked second. It was close to first. It was kind of between third and first, about average. Trying to remember the numbers more or less. The worst year was 2017. That was the year we had Maria, Irene, and the one over Houston that my mind just blanked on, Harvey. That's what it is. Those were huge hurricanes with devastating impacts. We were just behind that this year. When you think of Helene and some of these others and the impacts that they had, catastrophic. The third place was 2005 with Hurricane Katrina. And I think Matthew might have been that year as well. All right. Oh, by the way, you can see, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see I've got sources here at the bottom. This is just the name of the article, but I do have links here in the slideshow. I plan on putting the slideshows for all of my episodes onto Patreon. If you want to, you can come, you can download the slideshows, you can view them, you can do whatever you want with them. And those will include these source links as well. Just a couple quotes here on summer heat, because we did have the warmest summer on record as well. Quote, during the past 3 months of 2024, the globe has experienced the hottest June and August, the hottest day on record, and the hottest boreal summer on record. These quotes are from C3S Deputy Director Samantha Burgess. Her other quote was here, the temperature-related extreme events witnessed this summer will only become more intense, with more devastating consequences for people and the planet unless we take urgent action to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And, you know, Samantha, bless her heart, thinks that if we take dramatic actions that we can reverse the effects. Said it 100 times, we'll say it a million more. We can't reverse the effects at this point because of tipping points. We can slow it down. We can take action that will reduce the consequences and the rapidity and the intensification of those consequences. But it's so black and white to say, like, if we just take action, we can avoid this. We can't avoid it, but we can slow it down. So action is still important. All right, geopolitics and war. So there was several intensifications and new examples of tensions and wars throughout the world. The Israel-Palestine war, believe it or not, started at, you know, a year and 4 months ago. It feels like it's been going for so much longer than that. It's the bulk of it, the majority of it, took place during this year, 2024, as it only started in October of 2023. We're approaching 45,000 deaths in Palestine. Those are like registered, acknowledged deaths, right? Most likely the number is much higher than that. And 45,000, like, you get into numbers and it feels like, oh, is that a lot? Is that not a lot? I don't really know. Well, first of all, any life is important, right? 45,000 deaths represents something like 2.5% or so of the entire nation, of all of the people who live there. And it gets so much worse when you realize that those 45,000 deaths, the vast majority, like, I don't remember the numbers, but it's like 90% or something like that, are women and children. It's just atrocious. And I don't know how you can get away with not calling it a genocide, one that is perpetrated by Israel and supported by the U.S. and other Western nations. Middle East risk of destabilization. So this Israel-Palestine war is obviously a huge part of that. It's a source of it. It's also a reason. It's a symptom of it, you could say. Widening conflict into neighboring countries. We are seeing Israel attack in Lebanon against Hezbollah, other neighboring countries. We're seeing now, of course, this sort of Iran involvement. Iran, through proxies, but at the same time, we're also seeing sort of direct aggression between Israel and Iran. And there's this kind of constant game that they play with threats, and there will be a small attack. A person will be targeted in Iranian leadership, for example. And then the response is luckily not escalated. Who knows if that will continue, but any time that you do this, you really do threaten and put at risk the entirety of the Middle East. So we also saw this Syria regime change with Assad's regime coming down. The vacuum that is to be filled there, you know, this rebel group has taken control. Will they maintain control? And what will their control be? Will it be better for Syria and for Syrians? Or is it going to be just as oppressive? It seems like in many ways it is going to be the same story, but just different authors. A lot of the same types of oppression, but there also may be some good things that come from it. So time will tell. But again, as you cause these changes to happen rapidly, vacuums, power dynamics, all of these things come into play. And when you have major nations, world powers playing the proxy game through those smaller nations in the Middle East, it's really hard to say what could come of it. It feels like It feels like the West wants war with Iran, just based on the way that they're talking. We've got, this is just a side thing, I guess, an anecdote, but you think about like the whole drone thing in New Jersey, which I'm hoping will blow over, especially by the time this is being released. But you've got a congressman going on to the news saying, I have it on good authority. I have a source in the White House who is telling me that these drones are coming from Iran, that Iran has a mothership off the coast of the U.S., and they have put these drones over our skies. What? These are our elected congressmen saying these types of things, and there's all sorts of other rhetoric. It just feels like war is inevitable, and I hope that that is wrong, because it is not a war that we should want to find ourselves in. No war is one we should want to find ourselves in, but... Okay, tensions in Asia. So there's this potential for conflict that's been brewing for a long time between China and Taiwan. This year, nothing really came of it as far as like action taken. There was a lot of talking, and primarily it was the president of China telling Biden, like, you will not infringe, right? We will do what we want to do. You'll stay out of Taiwan and out of our way. And there was that conversation had now with the incoming President Trump on the same thing. And it seems like President Trump will also likely stay out of the way and allow it. So, you know, there's this fear, and I'm not trying to get into predictions here, but this idea that Donald Trump is going to put America first, which in his eyes means completely retreating from geopolitics for the most part, especially where we've already committed. And that could, again, create this ability for some of these nations to take bold action, knowing that there won't be any consequences from the U.S. So whether or not we see anything between China and Taiwan this next year is up for debate. Okay, North Korean troops in Ukraine. This is just another example of sort of the, I guess you can't really call this one proxy. This is just more Russia directly doing a quid pro quo, making a deal. You send us your troops, we will provide you with something in return. I think in the end, it was some sort of jets or other military equipment that they promised to North Korea in exchange for the use of their troops, which ended up being a disaster. The troops were so poorly trained that it sounds like they were ineffective and not really able to be used. So, but just the fact that they're willing to do that, it means a couple of things. Number one, it means Russia is desperate. They need troops, and they're willing to do a lot to get them. What does that signal for the future of the war? I don't know. And that takes us to our next point, which is the Russia-Ukraine war. So there was bolder incursions this year. We saw Ukraine retaliate and actually move into Russia with strikes and boots on the ground. That was not something that we had seen previously from Zelensky. Again, it just creates a higher chance for escalations and desperation from Russia as they potentially lose ground and troops. And then lastly, this continued threat of nuclear conflict or NATO incursion. So there's this worry from a lot of those in NATO that Russia will be emboldened to either use tactical nuclear weapons or that they will attack into NATO. Now with President Trump again in office, there is this thought process that, you know, he may completely reject any NATO commitments, and therefore, you know, Russia may feel emboldened to incur into Poland or other countries, and they may dip their toes in the water to see what they can get away with. Honestly, the fact that Russia can't even maintain a war in Ukraine, and it's been such a failure for them, seems like an awfully dumb move to spread, you know, into NATO countries and to further dilute themselves. However, Putin is old and maybe sick and maybe very desperate to do whatever he feels like he can do to maintain power as his empire crumbles. So, yeah, a lot to be seen there, but that's kind of what took place this year. Protests and riots throughout the world. The country of Georgia, there was questions about election integrity and a delay in their vote to join the EU. It was seen as, it was a former soccer star in Georgia who won the election, and the videos have been downright fascinating to watch and inspiring. There's something about a good riot, you know? There's something about watching the average person stand up to a government. There's, I guess, there's a video of one of the leaders is a female. I don't know how old she is. I was going to say student, but I don't know if that's correct. But she just stands there, protest after protest, getting just pelted by the water cannons. But the look in her eyes is just pure determination. And anyway, it inspires a lot of awe and respect for me. And I hope that things in Georgia turn out well. In South Korea, just recently, you may have heard the news that there was martial law declared. The president knew he was going to be ousted, did not like that, tried to take matters into his own hands, tried to keep the Congress. I don't know if Congress is the right word for those in South Korea, but tried to keep them out of their chambers where they would go to put forth their votes and all of that. Anyway, he failed. They snuck in. They unanimously voted to overturn the martial law and remove him from power. So again, great to see another successful thwarting of fascism. Bangladesh, student-led protests over laws showing favoritism in government jobs. So there was pretty violent backlash from the government against these students. It led to at least 400 protesters dead. This was another one where there were a lot of videos coming out, and these were more devastating to see because of the violence and the dramatic reactions from the police and the government. It just shows that the level of corruption from the government down through the police and the ability for a police force to sort of quash rebellions is also alive and well. And yeah, those students stood up for themselves. And in the end, the heavy hand came down and a lot of them paid for it with their lives. And in the UK, misinformation fueled protests and counter protests over this stabbing. You may remember there was, I don't remember the whole story, Taylor Swift birthday party, somebody was stabbed. And the misinformation that came from it was that it was an immigrant. And in the UK, they are experiencing much of what the US is experiencing right now in their xenophobia, in the attempts to cease all immigration and scapegoat immigrants into being terrible people and the source of all problems for the country, which of course is not true. Is there problems with immigration? Sure, absolutely. Too much immigration can do things to economies. And can there be bad people amongst immigrants? Sure. Is it going to be any higher than the bad people amongst the normal native population? Unlikely. So yeah, this misinformation led to a whole bunch of protests over immigration and thankfully counter protests, and it kind of fizzled out, but it goes to show just what's simmering in the background and something that I think is going to play a big part in our next decade or so of politics, which is the increase in immigration. People are losing their homes. People are scared to be in their homes because of political reasons, because of climate change and all these different things. And it's going to continue to be an issue. Okay, pandemic. So COVID-19. Luckily, from a deaths perspective, COVID-19 has calmed way down. It hasn't stopped. They're still in the thousands of deaths being reported every week due to COVID-19. But deaths don't necessarily, they're not a perfect indicator of all of the consequences of COVID-19. We still have long COVID. Every time that you get COVID, you increase your chances of long COVID or other long-term health issues related to it. So even in mild cases, that can be an issue. And if COVID stays around for a long time, now that it is considered endemic, this could mean more and more people slowly getting long COVID and increasing the long-term disability issues there. Western Australia reported 75 plus hospitalizations per day here recently due to COVID-19. It's still spiking in certain areas. It's still causing major issues. There's still new variants and things coming out. They are less deadly variants, but nonetheless, this is still an issue. It's causing economic problems. It's causing deaths. It's causing heartache and problems. Okay, H5N1. We sort of saw this spike up, not this year, but the year before, and then continue into this year. And it's really turned more and more into this when, not if scenario. And it's yet to be determined how devastating H5N1 will be. So this is bird flu. You know, this is the one that in the over the past 50 years or so, they've said it's got a death rate, a mortality rate of like 50%, right? And it's not expected that if it does become a full-on pandemic that it would have that high of a mortality rate as they mutate, as they change in a way that can be spread human to human. That often means that it becomes more contagious but less deadly. And that seems to be the case so far. But it is completely unknown what the final form of H5N1 would be, and the exact clade or the exact type that could be spread human to human, and what that genome will look like. So at this point, it does seem more and more likely, especially just in the last few months with some updates that we've received on H5N1, that it will probably at some point move to spread human to human. And then from there, it will have to be seen how devastating is that really. There, one of those updates was that it was found in pigs, which is something that had not been seen before. And anytime a disease makes its way into pigs, it becomes much more likely to be able to spread to humans and from human to human, because there are so many similarities to the immune systems between pigs and humans. Same things with ferrets and some other mammals. So 2023 was the year that we really saw it spread amongst birds. And it was terrifying because birds were dropping dead left and right. And then slowly it started making its way to certain mammals. And this year was the year that we saw it spread very quickly through mammals. And let's hope that next year is not the year that we start to see it spread from human to human, especially here in the U.S. as we go from a administration that at least pretends to care about our health into an administration that openly does not when it comes to pandemics and vaccines and those types of things. There was recently a mystery disease in Congo that scared the world as it killed dozens and spread quickly. Just recently, they claimed to have discovered that it was severe malaria. This highlighted for me the sort of panic that came from not knowing what this disease was and how long it took to discover it. It was like a month that it was spreading before they just found out what was happening. Many nations of the world could have a disease start there and spread from there. And it doesn't take long from patient zero, depending on the R naught of the virus, to spread very quickly. And so this isn't just true of nations in Africa. There are many nations in the world where we're not on top of pinning down what the disease is, where it's coming from, how dangerous it is before it gets out of hand. Luckily, this was not one that had a huge R naught value, that had a huge rate of contagiousness. And so it will hopefully be contained, especially now that they know what it is. But if it was something like COVID or another disease, it could rapidly spread and grow from these types of nations with low reporting capabilities and a slow turnaround for mitigation. Okay, a few items in the technology category. So AI advancement this year was, I think we saw some things in AI that both fascinate me. Look, I like technology from a curiosity perspective. I like technology from the perspective of like science fiction, you know, that type of thing. It's interesting to me. It's also extremely problematic. I'm fascinated by AI, to be completely honest. I think it is so cool to learn about, to see what it can do. But like, there is no denying the issues that are coming from it and that will continue to come from it, and the huge question marks around how much it will advance and what that advancement will mean. So misinformation and disinformation, we saw plenty of that this year. There's lots of security concerns over the continuing growth of AI. And there is, of course, the environmental impact. You know, with some of these new models that are coming out, Sora, or some of these bigger, even just the LLMs and I think I saw somewhere that LLMs, like asking ChatGPT a question, costs 10 times more in environmental impact than Googling something. And luckily, we have way more Google. I shouldn't say luckily because both are bad, but we don't have as many GPT requests as we do Google searches, right? But that is going to change. That's going to change rapidly. If Google went away, or Google, as far as like a search engine, went away and was replaced by ChatGPT and the predecessors of ChatGPT, which will use more power, then suddenly we've just 10 times the amount of impact just from searching the internet for information. So things like that, you know, data centers are going to produce 2.5 billion tons of CO2 through 2030, which is around 7% of all emissions just from data centers. For reference, in 2010, that number was 160 million tons. So from 160 million tons to 2.5 billion tons, that was in 2010, it was about 0.5% of emissions. So it's a 14x increase in the proportion of emissions that it emits across all spectrum. So just crazy. Cryptocurrency, Bitcoin produces the CO2 emissions of mid-size nations. We are here, when was Bitcoin introduced? 15 years ago or something. And it's bigger than ever. You know, and it with all the other types of cryptocurrencies, the altcoins, the NFTs, the meme coins and all of this stuff. Like, it's just mining it, producing it, all of that stuff takes a ton of emissions, and it's not going anywhere, at least not anytime soon, especially as it seems that more and more nations buy into it and more people believe it's going to stick around. Lastly, I'll just mention quantum computing. A lot of resources being expended, a lot of energy resources being expended in trying to research quantum computing. Alphabet, which is Google, just announced this Willow chip. Essentially, they're claiming that it's a one step towards quantum computing and that we're on the verge of a major breakthrough. Seems like there's still a long ways to go before we hit actual quantum computing. And some people say that even if we hit it, it's not really going to have the impact that people think. It will never replace the way we do computing now. There's debate on that. But there are major concerns about quantum computing. Cryptographic vulnerabilities. So essentially, quantum computing could break all of the ways that we view cybersecurity right now, including things like cryptocurrency. You've got these wallets with, I don't know, all of the stuff that goes into the security, but that's the whole purpose of crypto, is to be ultra secure. And they're saying that that quantum computing, if discovered, could truly break all of that, which would mean that nothing on the internet is ever safe ever again. The amount of energy usage and the technological disparities. So as we continue to advance technologically, it is, of course, only certain people or certain nations that get to take advantage of that technology. And so developing nations or underdeveloped nations, the poor in developed nations, do not get to take advantage of these technologies as much, and it widens those gaps. Okay, a few notes on ecological and environmental situations in 2024. These are a couple of those examples that I mentioned earlier. They might be super niche. They might be things you haven't heard of before, but I thought it would be interesting to just touch on a few. So one is Venezuela tourism projects. So in Venezuela, as their economy has been faltering, they've made an effort and a push towards creating these new tourism projects to bring people from around the world to help increase their economy. But in the meantime, they have destroyed coral reefs, mangroves, nesting beaches for endangered species. It's putting much of those ecosystems at real risk. And, you know, you think about the whole reason that you might visit Venezuela is for those very items. You're going there for the natural beauty. You're going to explore those coral reefs, the mangroves. You want to see the beautiful forests and their oceans and all of that. Yeah. The more that, again, this is a feedback loop, if the very act of increasing tourism is destroying those things, you'll rapidly see the tourism go away. And it may be too late to bring those beautiful natural resources back. So just an interesting thought. There's an IPBES report this year. That's the Intergovernmental Science Policy Platform on Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services. I don't know who came up with the name. You couldn't pay me to like memorize that. But this report estimates the global economy suffers losses up to $25 trillion annually due to sectors like agriculture and energy failing to account for their negative impacts on nature. So this is interesting because we hear about models all the time and, you know, they try and put numbers to the amount of estimated, you know, loss due to climate change and all of that. This report's saying $25 trillion annually due to those sectors failing to account for the negative impacts. So because it's such a complex, hyper-complex system, it would be impossible to account for every negative impact in those models. In this case, they're saying $25 trillion annually is missed out, which is, I mean, $25 trillion, those are silly numbers. Okay, Loch Ni. I said that wrong. But it's a lake in Northern Ireland, experienced catastrophic cyanobacteria blooms in the summers of 2023 and 2024, causing ecological degradation, impacting wildlife and local communities. Another hyper-specific example, I would be curious to hear if you live in Northern Ireland, what sort of impact have you seen or heard about? Is this something that people talk about in the area? Would be interesting to know because, and maybe this is something I could dig in deeper and do an actual full episode on later on. We don't often hear about the hyper-specific examples of climate change or of ecological, of environmental biodiversity degradation. And so, yeah, I'd love to hear firsthand from someone in the area about the impacts that that is having. All right, moving on. Economic and financial issues this year. So apparently, don't know if you've noticed, but people are pessimistic about the economy. Inflation is down, which is great because inflation was extremely high. But so many people are saying that times are harder than ever. And there's no doubt that when you look at how prices have increased, even though inflation has come down from 8%, that doesn't mean that prices aren't continuing to grow or that we've reversed the price increases that we've had over the last 5 years. We have not done so. It's coming back under control, which is great because if it was still out of control, living would be pretty much impossible, would lead to hyperinflation and all of that. But rent didn't go back down after it went up, right? Food prices did not come back down. They're just going up more slowly than they were. Rent-to-income ratios have increased, and food prices rose roughly 28% in the last 5 years. 28%. And I guarantee you that income has not increased 28% in the last 5 years on average. Rising government debts. There's a lot of concern over the amount of debt the governments are taking on. Here in the U.S., government debt could reach 155% of GDP by 2050. It's already at 100% of GDP. So, like, our debts are as much as we make in a year. Donald Trump, Ramaswamy, Elon Musk are claiming to come in and gut the system in a way that will save money and get us out of debt. And this just harkens back to catabolic collapse and the fact that, look, we need those systems. We may not need them in the form that they are currently in. I'm not saying that there isn't a lot of waste because there is, but many people are going to be affected if those are gutted or completely removed, especially if it's not done in a thoughtful way. And I also don't think that gutting those is going to get us out of debt because we'll just increase our debts in other areas. I guarantee you Donald Trump is not going to decrease the amount spent on our military, right? That's just going to increase, which is, by the way, by far the largest expenditure from our taxes. All right, global economic issues. So we've got things like the Russian ruble in decline just in the last few months. It has struggled against the dollar. European economic woes, slowdowns in Germany, France, and UK. And what's interesting is that it's all for different reasons. None of it all comes from the exact same thing, But as mentioned so many times, the collapse manifests itself through economic woes. All right, as we approach here to the end, there's just a few more of these left. Infrastructure. So infrastructure is an interesting one because it's hard to get an overall look at it. Kellen and I have done in the past entire episodes based on the scorecards from infrastructure. I think we'll do that again. The Army Corps of Engineer does like a full report on it every couple of years. And so I will do another episode on that so we can kind of get a better idea of the overall state of things. Here's a few, again, specific examples of infrastructure issues this year. So the Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed in Baltimore, Maryland. It was hit by a container ship named Dolly. The economic impacts of that strike were at least $15 million a day. Now, you might hear about this and be like, okay, a ship hit the bridge. Like, Corey, how is that in any way at all related to collapse? I am not saying that the ship hit the bridge because of collapse. What I am saying is it shows vulnerabilities in our system and how much we rely on something as simple as a bridge collapsing, right? It shut down the entire river and cost $15 million a day. It slowed down supply chains. It caused all sorts of havoc and issues. We've seen over the last couple of years, and really the last 5 years since COVID-19, how vulnerable the supply chain is to little things like this and to the major things that can cause cascading problems down the line. From things like the Suez Canal a couple of years ago to war in Russia and Ukraine to loss of natural resources at the mouth, the base of the supply chain. So many issues can cause so many problems. CrowdStrike, there was a global IT outage. 8.5 million Windows systems crashed and costs exceeded $10 billion. And that was even after it was resolved fairly quickly. If it had taken longer to resolve, those costs would have exploded because so many businesses and people rely on their systems functioning. And this was due to like an update that went through that wasn't pushed through correctly. Guys, you want to talk about the fragility or the vulnerability of infrastructure. We rely so heavily on our technology, and the smallest blip of something going wrong can cause, you know, in this case, something that feels so small in comparison to what could happen. And we were lucky that it was resolved quickly. National power grid failures in Nigeria. I hadn't actually heard about this one. I came across this as I was doing research about this year. 10 major outages impacted large cities like Abuja, Lagos, and Kano in Nigeria. This occurred due to aging infrastructure and maintenance failures. And so, this harkens right back to catabolic collapse and collapse in general. We are not taking care of our stuff. And as it gets older and we don't replace it, it will start to fail. Queensland water infrastructure cost. This one was interesting. I wanted to highlight it because it has more to do with the difficulty of getting new projects done rather than the failure of old infrastructure. There were 11 major projects, all went over budget significantly. Some of those projects were four times the budgeted amount. That causes issues. Number one, because it means that those projects may be delayed. Number two, it means the projects may not get done at all. And number three, it means that it puts in jeopardy the future projects. If you do end up pulling the budget to make this happen, that budget has to come from somewhere. It either increases the debt or it means that there's less that you can do in other areas. And when you put all your resources in one basket, it allows your other infrastructure to fail if it's not getting maintained properly, et cetera, et cetera. So anyway, these are all fun examples and interesting examples of catabolic collapse. All right. Lastly, some U.S.-specific examples. Some people are like, Corey, you're too U.S.-centric. I'm in the U.S. This is my perspective. Look, if you want a perspective of someone who lives somewhere else, they're out there. Please go find them. It is what it is because this is what I think about and see every day because I'm living it. So Donald Trump was reelected in the United States and it's brought up so many questions. If there was any one terrible piece of news, in my opinion, for the US and the world as a whole, as we move into collapse, it was this. I'm not saying that having a Democrat president would fix things. I'm not saying that the status quo is good. But this has the potential to be so bad for so many people, individuals, groups of people, and just for all of us through widespread implications of things like Project 2025, of the cabinet picks that Donald Trump has chosen, and the inadequacy of experience, the inappropriateness of like the of what those people's aims are and what they want to achieve, what Donald Trump himself wants to achieve. Anyway, you know, I don't need to go into it all. You know what the issue is and why it's bad. I do ask this question about what does it say about us? Like, does it say that half of people in the U.S. are dumb, that we're stupid? Does it mean half people in the U.S. are malicious? Does it mean that they're desperate? I think it means many of those things, maybe all of them at once, maybe some in some ways more than others. But it points to a real, and this is the last point I've got here on the slide, social malaise. Like, something's not right. If people are so unhappy that they're voting for this, things are not right. And I don't know if you've noticed it, and I'm sure this is not just a U.S. thing, but things are shifting. Like, there's just this change in the air to the way people think and talk and interact with each other. As I've watched interactions on social media and what gets people's attention on social media, and it just feels like we are numb, but at the same time, there are these little glimpses of society realizing what's going on. Luigi Mangione was one just from this month, right? Did we get a glimpse into collective class consciousness? He was celebrated for what he did, right? I talked about this on the bonus episodes in Patreon. I spent some time on social media, TikTok and all those, gauging what the conversation was. And it seemed, at least the way the algorithm set it up to me, that everyone was talking about class issues and class warfare. People were making songs and music and poems alluding to class warfare and to what goes into class divide and how to change it. And they were being liked and shared and viewed millions of times. Is that going to fade away rapidly? Do things like drones in the sky deflect away our attention? Probably. Does anything come of it? I don't know. But it's interesting to watch people's reactions, and I'm fascinated to see, does it stick at least a little bit the next time that something happens? Do people, instead of thinking inside their minds, like, this just doesn't feel right. Why did this piece of corruption that seems to have just happened, am I the only one that like noticed this? Now people may know, people who are not familiar with class consciousness before, people who didn't understand the way that the system works. Now that they do, and they know that other people know it too, can we talk about it every time? I don't know. I have no idea. Can the political bipartisan, I guess I shouldn't say bipartisan, but the two-party system, can that be traversed? Can we look past left versus right or Republican and Democrat, the petty issues that divide us and the tensions, to actually say, hey, look, no, we are after the same thing here. And it's that we don't want to be oppressed by the ruling class any longer. I don't know. And my attempt here is not to make predictions about that, at least not in this episode. I do want to do a prediction episode. I will likely release that next week or in the coming weeks. Typically, Kellen and I would do predictions at the end of this episode in the past and just give a few items that we thought we might expect for the next year. I'm going to do a whole episode on it, not because I think my predictions are right. I I do not think that, nor because I think they're important, because I don't think my predictions are important. But as I've talked about in one of the other episodes, predictions are fun. And I think they're at least worth writing down. I'd love to hear other people's predictions. So by me putting mine out there, I also want to invite others to mention theirs, what they think the next year will look like. And I may also just kind of put out my predictions for the next 5 or 10 years. So that'll be probably the next episode. I think some of these also may have gotten out of order. I recorded a few episodes in a row before releasing any, and then realized that I wanted this episode to go out right at the end of the year. So it may have gotten out of order where this one actually ended up getting released before one that I had previously already recorded. And that one may not come out for a couple more weeks if I do it after the prediction episode. So if I said something in that episode alluding to like me doing this episode in the future, that's why it got all out of order. All right. Join me on Patreon. It means so much to me to have that support. And I also try and provide as much value as I can there. You can just search Collapse Pod on patreon.com. I will also include a link here for you to join. There you'll get weekly bonus episodes. I spend 15 to 30 minutes on those episodes, typically talking about issues that are happening right now, talking about the news. I talk about different sources. Sometimes other people who are talking about Collapse, I like to go through what they do, help people find more resources, that type of thing. And sometimes I just talk. Sometimes I talk about my personal life. Sometimes I talk about personal anecdotes and things like that. And I intend to get more and more personal in the future as well. I think, you know, the first 140 episodes of this podcast, I didn't have, there was no filming of it. I felt sheepish about people knowing who I was and all of that. I don't really care anymore, quite frankly. Anyway, this is the part of the episode where I ramble. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here. Please feel free to reach out with comments, questions, concerns. I'll even take your hate. Bring it on. Let's see what you got. Thanks. Hey, Corey here. If you are listening to the back catalog of Breaking Down Collapse, thank you. Those episodes are so vital. They're so important. But I also wanted to let you know that I am now doing daily episodes. Yes, that's right. Here on the podcast, daily episodes. So if you are enjoying the back catalog, great. Please also feel free to zoom forward to the most recent episodes. Catch us daily. They are quick little episodes, and I think you'll enjoy them. Thanks.